Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning, good morning. And I tell you, if last week we had a sweet program.
Now we have a cheesy one.
We have a cheesy program.
Don't say that. We have a program about cheese.
We have a program about cheese led off by a famed, renowned, however you'd like to call him, absolute worldwide expert on cheese who just happens to be based in New York City. Max McCalman, he's been on the program before, but he just produced a wonderful new book we talked to him about. And we also talked to him about the subject of cheese in general, and American cheese in particular. And then following Max in the program, three people we met recently who have wonderful cheese programs of their own that they're going to talk to us about. And guess what? They're all from the United States, too.
Yes.
So let's hear it for the good old US of A and cheese this Sunday in On the Menu.
You know, Max McCalman, we've talked to you, but not for a long time. And in that period in between our conversations, you produced another absolutely masterful book, the title of which is Mastering Cheese, Lessons for Connoisseurship. Oh, I'm stumbling over that one. From a Maître Fromager. Is that it?
That's it.
That's a long title. But in any event, you're still doing essentially the same thing, but for a different employer. In a way now, aren't you? Artisanal still exists, but in a way it's different.
Yes, the restaurant from which we sprang is still the cheese destination restaurant. But with the success of the cheese program at the restaurants, Picheline first, I call it the shrine, and then artisanal bistro and fromagerie second, we saw that there was a growing appetite for retail and wholesale business and with an educational component. So the idea for the Artisanal Cheese Center, artisanalcheese.com, came into being. And so that's where I'm affiliated strictly with the Artisanal Cheese Center.
You are Dean of Curriculum.
Yes.
You're subtitled, by the way, and I think this is absolutely indisputable, America's preeminent expert on cheese. So you have a dense book, and we're going to talk about how we're going to figure it out.
Well, just quickly, though, artisanal, the cheese business remains in place, and in fact, it's just bigger and better, I guess, and owned by somebody else, but bigger and better than it ever was, and in the business of aging its own cheese.
Correct. It's an online retailer and also a wholesaler with the single classroom. And so I oversee most of the curriculum, teach many of the classes. I assist with the sourcing selection of cheeses, and with the website editing and content.
So you're a little bit like Neil's Yard in London, right? You actually buy the cheeses from the cheesemakers who make it. You take it and you make sure it's aged properly until such time as you decide you want to bring it to market?
That is our goal, and hopefully to acquire the cheeses a little bit on the young side so that we can bring them to peak without going over peak and then develop or continue the ripening in our state-of-the-art cheese maturing cave.
So if you like to buy cheese in New York, artisanal is a great place to go get it. If you like to buy it online, and you should, this is also a great place to get it, because this man knows his cheese. I don't know how to describe this book, because it's like a four-year college degree program in everything from how cheese gets made, where it's made, what it goes with, how to buy it, How to put together a cheese program in a restaurant. There's absolutely everything in here. What were you trying to do, Max?
Well, the proposal from my publisher was to write a book entitled Mastering Cheese, which at first seemed like a brilliant idea. But then I started thinking about it. Wait a minute. Well, we better have a disclaimer underneath that title, because say that if you absorb everything in this book that you are a cheese master. It seems like it's such a big world, and there are so many parts of it that the subtitle is Lessons for Connoisseurship, from a Maître Fromager.
Well, here's what I'd suggest. I see what you think of this idea. If you actually ate the cheese and drank the beer and wine alongside it as you went through the book, in addition to reading the book, I believe you truly would, in fact, become a master.
I think it helps.
And you have a brilliant suggestion in there. I was just reading about cheese. It's not to just taste the cheese once. Taste it again and again and again at different ages, at different times of the day, with different beverages, because it won't be the same.
Precisely. And even from the same cut of cheese, It doesn't have to be a different wheel. Some, especially the more artisanal type cheeses, cheese being a living food, do change. They fluctuate, and so it may not be, may not offer the same flavor or aromatic or texture profile on a second pass. And this is one thing that, that wine and beer and spirit can do for cheese. They provide a platform to be able to zero in on those nuances.
Right. Now, there's a particular area that I want to focus attention on, because you mentioned it, and obviously you practice it at artisanal, but people can't practice it at home, and that's keeping cheese at the right temperature while you're aging it, and then later on after you've bought it, and you can't eat it at one sitting. What do you suggest?
One of the... a former colleague of mine had a pretty good rule of thumb. With cheese, you treat it the way you would treat your fish purchases. You don't buy fish for 2 weeks from today. You purchase for today, tomorrow, the next day, perhaps, and leave the storage or the maturing certainly to the experts. So buy less, but buy often. But that being said, cheese can put up with quite a lot of abuse. And we do ship cheeses in cheese-friendly paper, the type of paper that is used in the better cheese shops in Western Europe, that is a two-ply semi-permeable paper. It allows the cheese to breathe, and it's not suffocating in thick plastic that way.
There you go. We have a piece of Uplands cheese, which we're going to talk about a little bit later in the program, that came, I think, in that kind of very heavy paper, and it's a little bit waxy on the inside.
Precisely.
Yes.
So that's the best way to keep it. Now, they sent us, so it's going to be a while before we finish it all, and we're keeping it in the refrigerator. We possibly shouldn't even do that, should we?
Well, one thing that, that, especially with a cut piece of cheese, it will keep the cheese, the cut piece of cheese, in a more static state, so that it's like allowing it to take a nap. You keep it cool, because cheese evolving continuously, especially a cut piece of cheese, you want to slow down the degradation of the cheese. And this can be even a more industrial type cheese. The refrigeration will just slow down the ripening. Keep it close, or as close to its original condition as possible. I used to worry a lot about leftover cheeses. Then again, I don't keep cheese for extended periods of time. If it does get to the point where the cheese looks like it's not in peak form, then I might use it for soups, or I might use it as a part of an omelet or cooking or
freeze it. Chefs do that all the time. They take all the little bits and freeze them, and then when they need something, they just put them all together. I don't quite get the point of it, but that's what they tend to do.
We have a heel of Parmesan that we've had in the refrigerator for at least 4 years. And every time we make a stew, they say you can throw the heel of Parmesan in the stew, and I always forget. And then I say, why didn't I do that? Why didn't I do that? And it's still there.
May I say about this book, Max, that your food stylist and photographer should be highly congratulated. They should really feel like it. You look at these cheeses, the photographs, and you can see the texture. You feel like you could taste it.
Yeah, I had a field photographer that worked with me for the and then a studio photographer for the quote-unquote beauty shots. And so both very capable in that. Of course, the pictures are what sells the book. And it is a beautiful book. And I hope that people will also take time to read the book, because there's some good lines in the book, and there's a lot of information, as you say.
There are some absolutely fabulous lines in the book. But the... Now, we could keep Max on the phone all day, but one of the things we asked him to do for us today, aside from introducing Artisanal and introducing his book.
Wait, I had a question, though.
Oh, excuse me.
One question.
Go ahead.
Before we get into the plan, is I read that Au Revoir, all that, and it had a very devastating report on the state of French cheeses. Do you say that that's true today?
I would say that, if anything, the French cheeses in general have just suffered because of their popularity. And there are still some fabulous cheeses produced around France. Unfortunately, we're not able to legally acquire the young, unpasteurized varieties. We can get the aged varieties that are unpasteurized, but there's some good cheeses made with pasteurized milk, too. And so the French have done an exceedingly good job, I would say, of putting flavors back into cheeses that have been subjected to heat treatment or pasteurization.
Right.
And so by selections of cultures and secondary cultures and yeast and bacteria and treatments, some of these cheeses taste very close to the real deal, the original thing. They may not have as much aroma. I want to be optimistic about what happens in France, and there are corners of France that have maintained their, I'd say, their standards of great making of cheeses in the old style, partly because they age out to 60 days. There are types of cheeses that don't have to be, are not consumed less than 60 days.
Right.
Pyrenees, the Auvergne, the Haute-Savoie, primarily southern France, not quite as much of the Burgundian types or the Normandy or the Loire Valley types, because they're mostly on the younger side. Do we see those? But again, the French have been able to put some good cheese making craft into making sure that we get at least as close to the flavor as what we're expecting.
Well, before Anne asked the question, we were going to make a transition, and Max knows that already, because I think that we agreed. Before we came on the air, Max, I think we agreed that the most exciting country in the world, as far as cheese development is concerned, is these United States of ours. Don't you agree?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. This past American Cheese Society conference, which was held in Austin, Texas, this past August 2009, had a record number of entries into competition, 1,327 entries. And we thought there might be a little bit of a drop-off because of a little bit of a downturn in the economy. And this is not everybody. This gives an idea how much is there. But not only is the number of artisan cheesemakers is growing, it's dramatic, but it's also the quality of cheeses. There was a time that I thought that I could skip 1 year of the conference years ago because I didn't see a lot of change from 1 year to the next. But now you can't miss it because it is exciting. Every state in the union is, even Alaska is making cheese. So
this is not just Americans competing with Americans for the title for the best American cheese. These are cheeses that are winning prizes at the international cheese festivals
and
gaining
right.
recognition around the world. So we're absolutely at the top. And it's curious that it's really not curious at all, that one of the interviews coming up in this program is with Mike Gingrich from Uplands in Wisconsin. And he's in your book. And he's a fascinating little story in his own right, which you'll be telling us a little bit later on. But
I think cheesemakers are fascinating.
Give me your perspective on Mike. You had a little discussion with him about breed versus feed.
Yes. For this book, one thing that we were trying to answer in this book is what is more important what is the most important factor contributing to the flavor in cheese? Is it the species or is it the vegetation?
In this case, the species of the cow, not the species of the grass.
Right. And Mike believes that it's certainly the vegetation. But I have seen cheeses made with Jersey milk or Holstein Friesian or Ayrshire or other, and the milk quality is different. I know that there is some factor there, but I know that what the animals are eating has a big part, but what is a breakdown in percentage of the influence of flavors? I don't know. It's hard to say that it's 80% vegetation. I don't know. But
I think there's another huge component too, and that is how well the person making the cheese knows how to make it.
Absolutely.
It's feed, breed, and then the skills of a cheesemaker. And a wonderful tribute Mike gave, and also Car Valley Cheese and Beehive Cheese from Northern Utah, who are also going to be on this program. All three of them were hugely indebted to the land-grant universities, Utah State and the University of Wisconsin, for opening the doors and helping them to learn how to make the best cheese that they could.
Right. That's great to see that many states are supporting their this cottage industry, cheesemakers, and recognizing that this is an important commodity. And it's also one way that a family farm or a cooperative can be viable
exactly.
and remain sustainable.
I was surprised, though, that Mike was talking about he's totally seasonal. I mean, I spent a lot of time on a dairy farm, and I can't imagine how you get any money if you do a natural seasonal progression of when you have milk and when you don't.
Well, he said he wouldn't be able to do it if he wasn't really making it selling his milk because he wasn't getting the value that he thought he ought to get. So I'm sure he did his financial modeling very carefully and figured out that at a certain scale he could make enough cheese enough cheese in a year to get by, and that's exactly what he does. Anyway, you're going to hear his story, Beehive and Car Valley, coming next. Max, what can we say to the audience about mastering cheese? I think we can say that this may not be every important word about cheese, but all the additional ones were edited out in order to be able to bring the book in at under 5 pounds weight.
Well, I mean, it's some way that people can get. I mean, he's very lucid, Max. You're very lucid about explaining the history of it, the components of it. You know, just it's all very logical. And then, of course, there's the passion for your cheese and the beautiful photographs. What kind of cheese, American cheese, do you think we do the best at? Cow, goat?
Well, no, just like pretty much the rest of the world. More than 90% of the cheese produced in the United States are cow's milk. Mm-hmm. And so we have a lot of practice with that. But we have had some great progress in goat milk cheeses. Surprisingly, it seems like most of the artisan goat cheese producers in the United States are women.
Yeah, because I think they're easier to handle, goats. I mean, they're smaller.
They're a lot easier to control than cows.
They're more docile. They're personable and extremely intelligent. I think cows and sheep are intelligent too, as well as water buffalo. But at the American Dairy Goat Association Awards several weeks ago, in which I was a judge, there were over 250 entries just of goat's milk cheeses alone, and many of them were outstanding. And because I was a judge, I didn't know all of them. I didn't know most of them, actually, who made this cheese. But I had judged that competition a few years ago, but there was nowhere near 250-plus cheeses entered into competition, and the quality is there. So I would like to see more sheep's milk cheeses produced mm-hmm. in the United States. There's some, and it's coming around. Car Valley does some work with sheep milk, and there's some here in the Northeast, and a little bit in the Northwest, but I would like to see more sheep's milk cheeses being produced.
Well, Max, let's wrap it up this way. What listeners, what you need to do, first of all, is buy the book, because then you'll know how to go about buying some cheese, and then swiftly thereafter, buy some beer, buy some wine of all the kinds that Max recommends, and then your cheese course will flow painlessly, and you will have a wonderful time, I promise you. Max,
yes.
Thank you so much for a huge contribution.
Thank you. The takeaway is cheese is a near-perfect food. It is a near-complete food. It has suffered from a bad rap for far too long, and part of my mission is to rescue cheese.
Well, you're doing a great job.
You sure are.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Ann and Peter.
Yeah, well, keep talking.
Yes, let's not wait too long before we speak again.
Great. Okay, Max, thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
It's amazing that any given person would know that much about cheese. Oh, while we digest that fact, let's take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Don't hesitate to give us a shout out or contact us through various forms of social media.
Which you can do right from the homepage because there are
exactly.
buttons for all your favorite stuff like Facebook and Twitter that Ann spends so much time on. And a blog Peter doesn't spend nearly as much time on as he should. But if you send me something, I'll blog you right back. When we talked to Max, you'll recall we talked about a Wisconsin cheesemaker called Mike Gingrich. And Mike has some very firmly held ideas about how you should go about making cheese and the value of feed versus breed. So we'll hear him tell the story of Uplands Cheese and also about why he thinks his cheese is superior, and it's all to do with the feed.
Mike Gingrich, you have a very interesting story to tell us. Tell us how you ended up producing Uplands Cheese.
Well, we had a dairy farm in Wisconsin, and we were doing something called rotational grazing, which is not the usual way of producing milk. Our cows are out on pasture from first grass growth in April through the end of the season in October. And so their diet is different. Their diet is fresh pasture, and they get a little bit of grain when they come in to get milk, whereas most cows are kept in confinement and fed corn silage and hay and other additives. So because of the different diet that our cows have, the milk that we produce has a lot richer dairy flavor, and so we felt like we had unique flavor properties in the milk we were producing, and we weren't able to take advantage of that. We weren't able to sell our milk at a premium. It was just going on a truck with everybody else's milk and going to cheese factories, and none of the uniqueness of our milk was being appreciated.
Now, you were a dairy farmer for a long time. Was the business in your family for a long time?
Not in my family. Well, my mother's family were all dairy farm people. My father was an accountant. I grew up in the suburbs, but I spent summers on my mother's family farm when I was a kid. And so as my children were born and started to go to school, I thought I wanted to get out of the suburbs and into the countryside and give them that experience. So my wife and I bought our first farm about 40 years ago, and our children were very small then. So then we were producing just milk, but in 1994 we bought this current farm with another couple to do this rotational grazing, as I was mentioning. And then after about 2 or 3 years of that, because of the feeling that we had unique flavor properties in the milk, we decided to look for a product that we could direct market and realize the benefits of flavor uniqueness of the milk we were producing.
Yeah, now I spent my summers in a dairy farm, too, in Ohio.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, then you know what I'm talking about. It's great.
Well, the thing I didn't understand, though, is that you keep your schedule with calving in the spring.
That's right. It's a seasonal operation, so all the cows have their calves in the spring, and then they produce milk through the grazing season, the growing season, and then just about this time of year, late November, early December, they start drying up, and they're dry all winter, and then have their calves again in March.
Now, is this something that everybody does, Mike? Or
no, that's quite unusual.
I don't know how you'd support yourself that. Without getting the milk.
Without a milk check in the wintertime, that's right. You have to have a good banker that will help you get through the winter, and you also have to be able to put enough aside during the good season, during the growing season, so that you can get through the winter. But it's a lower-cost way of producing milk. It's a much more old-fashioned and natural way. I like to say it's easier on the land, it's easier on the cows, and it's easier on the farmer.
And it's delicious cheese.
Yes. And it produces a rich dairy flavor in the milk that you don't get from store-bought milk.
Now, you make only one kind of cheese.
That's correct. When we decided we wanted to make a cheese product to realize the flavors in our milk, we looked at a variety of different European cheeses, and I selected those that had always been made from the milk of grass-fed cows and picked one that we liked in particular, which was a French Gruyere cheese called Beaufort, made in very small quantities in one area of the French Alps. And we liked that cheese, so we went to the university here in Wisconsin and asked them if they could help us figure out how to make a cheese like that with our milk. They were more than happy to help us, and so in 99 we made a number of experimental batches in very tiny little vats they have in their test lab, and I aged them in my basement that winter. And we selected the one we liked the best, and that determined our recipe, or our make procedure, as we call it in the cheese world. And so in 2000, we started making this cheese, which we called Pleasant Ridge Reserve. We actually rented space in a nearby cheese factory and made it off-site for the first 4 years. And then in 2004, when we developed our market to the point where we could justify building an on-farm cheese plant, we built a plant on the farm, and now we're able to make a lot more and make it with milk that's minutes old. when the last cow's milked in the morning, we start making cheese.
Wow.
Now, you don't pasteurize it along the way?
No, we don't.
No, okay.
As I said, we only use that summer milk when the cows are on fresh pasture. Then we use it very fresh, and we don't pasteurize it. We use very traditional methods and cultures to make the cheese, and then we age it in caves, which is also the traditional way of aging cheese, certainly cheese like this. Before refrigeration and plastic, all cheese was aged by keeping it in caves or cool environments and giving it various treatments. Ours is a washed rind cheese, so we wash the rind twice a week with a weak brine solution and turn it. But there's a lot more labor in aging it than there was in making it in the first place.
But you make very little. I mean, you're a small quantity producer, right?
Yes, that's right. Now that we're really as big as we could get, and we make about 100,000 pounds of cheese a year, but even the smallest commercial cheese factory around here could do that in a week.
Wow.
Oh, no kidding. Now, there's a great tradition, of course, in the whole of Wisconsin in cheesemaking, and I guess that's what led to the university program that you were a part of to get started?
Yes, that university program was a big, big help to us. They call it the Center for Dairy Research, and they do research on cheeses and other dairy products for the dairy industry in Wisconsin.
Now, put us a dot on the map, because I'm not terribly sure where Dodgeville, Wisconsin is.
Dodgeville, Wisconsin is due west of Madison.
Okay.
About 40 miles. That places it about halfway between Madison and the Mississippi River.
Okay, so it's like halfway to Minnesota.
That's right. Yeah, in Iowa.
Your cows are very pretty in your brochure.
Oh, well, thank you for my cows.
Well, if you look on our website, we have our cousin's son's cow. Is it Lucy?
Yeah, Lucy has to be the prettiest cow you've ever seen. You really have to go to the website to take a look. She's a Jersey cow, and he bought her for $50 because the owners thought she was blind and wouldn't be useful as a farm animal. So she's a pet. So he lives up on top of a hill in northern Tasmania, and Lucy lives in the field, and when he comes home, Lucy's like a dog. Lucy runs up, but he did admit that there's an electric fence between him and Lucy if he wants there to be, because her enthusiasm might be too much for him.
Yeah.
You know, you've won so many awards, including Best of Show to the American Cheese Society, which is the Blue Ribbon Cheese Organization, right?
Yes, that's right. That was our very first year in business. We started making Pleasant Ridge Reserve in the summer of 2000, and when it had aged about 8 months, we entered it into the American Cheese Society competition in 2001, and we won Best of Show that very first year.
That must be pretty thrilling justification for all the trouble you went to, huh?
Yes, yeah, it was just so gratifying, because we went into this on the theory that we, as I said, we had unique flavor properties in our milk, and so winning that award that very first year sort of validated our theory.
Right. Now, you sent us two pieces of cheese. Was one aged more than the other?
Yes. Okay. I would have sent you probably about a 5-month cheese and a 16 to 18 month cheese.
Okay, and that's the first one we tasted, and I have to say it was really delicious.
Oh, thank you.
So whatever you're doing it right, and I guess if you've been doing it all this time, you're going to keep on doing the same thing. Huh?
Well, thank you. I like to give the cows the credit, because they do all the selection. When they go out to pasture, they're very selective eaters. They'll take a bite of this and a bite of that, and they're roaming over the whole pasture looking for the tastiest forages there. And it's that process, I'm convinced, that gives us the special flavors that we get in that milk, because we let them eat what they want. They have to eat about half of what's out there, and then we move them to another pasture.
Gotcha.
They get new pasture every day, and so they're always getting fresh.
Oh, that's marvelous. So you're actually moving them with that degree of frequency.
Yes, yes. Every day we have 300 acres and divided into 20 separate pastures, and then we'll move them every day to fresh grass, to new grass. And as I say, they're very selective. They'll eat about half of what's there, and then we move them to the next pasture.
Well, they look very happy.
Well, they are.
Tell us how people get this cheese, Mike.
Well, we sell about 95% of our cheese wholesale. So it goes to restaurants, cheese shops, and gourmet markets all around the country, but primarily in larger metropolitan areas. So we also have a website.
Then you want to give us that?
Yes, www.uplandscheese.com.
And you can buy from the website?
And you can buy from the website. We ship all around the country. We've shipped all 50 states, and we ship fractional wheels. When we ship wholesale, it's full wheels, but we ship as small as a pound and a quarter, which is an eighth of a of a wheel, and we can ship those any place. And we ship Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, and we ship everything on a two-day basis, so it's not in the UPS system over the weekends.
Right. Now, do you have a store? Do you actually know what retail establishments you're in, Mike?
For the most part, we sell direct about half of our cheese, and the other half goes through distribution.
Okay.
So when it goes through distribution, we don't know where it winds up. But when we sell direct, we do.
So can people use the website to find out where it's available in their area?
No, but it's in almost every cheese shop.
Okay, all right. And if a listener would go to their favorite cheese shop and say, you need to get some of this, you'd be able to take care of that for them, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Or if they wanted to send me an email and say, your cheese should be in such and such a cheese shop, I'll call and suggest that they...
Great. Well, why don't we put that email address out on the program, too, then? Go ahead.
And that would be just contact, that's C-O-N-T-A-C-T, contact at uplandscheese.com.
Now, if only you could get the cows to turn the cheeses and wash them wash them with brine, you'd just be able to watch and just count the money.
Yes, that's true, but... But, no, the cows, I'm afraid, wouldn't be able to do that.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us on the menu. It's been a pleasure to sample your wonderful cheese.
And your life sounds absolutely idyllic.
Well, thank you. We just really enjoy it.
Now maybe it's time to move the cows.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Bye.
Bye.
Such a fascinating guy. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, moving right along to yet another wonderful cheese. It's so much fun knowing that all these great samples of cheeses are out there. This one called Car Valley, and we're still in Wisconsin, right?
We are in Wisconsin.
We're in Wisconsin.
Yeah, we are still in Wisconsin. I thought maybe we'd move to Utah already, but I was wrong. We're in Wisconsin, which is not surprising, I guess, because it's where all the cheese heads are. And this is wonderful cheese from Wisconsin. I think it's a whole lot like cheddar. And let's hear from Car Valley Cheese.
Sid Cook.
Sid Cook from Car Valley Cheese, coming right up.
Sid Cook, you sure look good with a big hunk of prize-winning cheese here in this brochure for Car Valley Cheese. Welcome to On the Menu.
Well, thank you very much, Ann.
Yeah, and you are a master cheesemaker for Car Valley Cheese, which is, I think you're the fourth generation, is that correct?
Yes, I am. My family started making cheese in Wisconsin in 1883.
Wow.
And my great-great uncle was a cheesemaker, and my grandparents, my parents, and my aunts and uncles, and great-aunts and uncles, and the whole family.
So it's not a surprise that you became a cheesemaker.
No, I guess my dad always says I just didn't know any better.
Now, where did the cheese... Let's begin with basics. Where did the cheese-making tradition in Wisconsin come from?
Well, it came from a number of different places. In our particular case, my ancestry is English and German, and so we ended up making cheddar cheese. But in some parts of the state, it was German, or it was Schweizerdeutsch, and so there's some people that were making Emmental and Brick and Munster. So I think it would be very fair to say that that the cheeses that were made here were the cheeses that the immigrants wanted to buy or were the ones that they knew and knew how to make.
But it also had to do with the fact that it was a good place to grow cows?
It's a great place for cattle. Originally in this area, it was a timber, lumber, and then there was wheat growing and hops, and then the dairying came in the 1870s, and really took hold.
So you do, though, cow, goat, and sheep cheeses.
Yes, we do.
And we've tasted these cheeses, and I must say they're absolutely fabulous. You've won just about every conceivable award, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I think to date we've won approximately 231 national and international awards in the last 5 years.
Wow. And tell me how many cheeses, and just give me an idea of the range of your products.
We make about 80 different cheeses. And we mentioned earlier, we do sheep milk, goat milk, cow milk, and then we also do mixed milk cheeses.
Oh, that's interesting. That's something that's not done a lot.
Exactly. So we have a beautiful goat-cow blend that we do. We also do one particular cheese that's a layer of sheep milk cheese, a layer of goat milk cheese with grapevine ash in the center. That one we call Mauvais. We also do six or eight cheeses that we mix sheep, goat, and cow milk together in certain ratios. And then we do different affinage on them. So some we grow native moles on the rind. Some we grow Limus brevium on the outside.
Now, you snuck that affinage word in there just for listeners who are not cheese aficionados. And give us explain that affinage thing.
What affinage is all about, and we really don't have a word that fits that in English, but it means to cure, it means to ripen, it means to grow molds, it means to finish the cheese in the manner and way that we want to have the cheese turn out. So it has to do with humidity, temperature, what we're growing on the surface, if we're drying the cheese out, if we're keeping it moist, all of those things have a final effect on how the cheese will finish. And that's what affinage means.
Well, now, is that learning how to do all that, is that part of the program, the master cheese making program that you said you have in Wisconsin?
Yes, it is. And the master cheese maker program here in Wisconsin, it takes about 15 years to become a master cheese maker.
Wow.
And you begin by doing an apprenticeship and getting a cheesemaker's license, which involves an exam. And then after you've made cheese for 10 years and a specific cheese that you want to do your master's in for 5 years, you can apply to the master's board, and you are then given a verbal examination of what you know, and if you pass that exam, you're accepted into the master's program, and then that's an additional 3 years.
Good grief, you must be ready to retire by then.
Well, just about. And that's an additional 3 years, and we take week-long courses quarterly for 3 years, and then we write a 28-page exam that takes about 50 hours to write.
Good
and
grief.
So it truly is like doing a master's, and the exam is like a thesis.
But they want to make sure you know all about it.
Well, they'd like to make sure that we know a little bit about cheese making, yes.
Well,
exactly.
But it doesn't necessarily guarantee you're going to make delicious cheese, and your cheese is delicious. What's the secret behind your product?
Well, cheese making is 50% art and 50% technical. And it's very easy to read about cheese making and learn the science part of it. But like many great things that you can do in life, there's a lot of things that you learn by experience, and that you learn from elders, and you learn from other people in the business, and you learn from your own experience. And I think that has a lot to do with making that little bit of difference, because in the cheese contest that we enter, it's always a very close race because there are many, many wonderful good cheeses. And the difficulty as a cheesemaker is to set yourself a bit apart from everyone else, to to have that little bit better flavor, that little bit better finish, to have those fruity notes, and really that's where, side of the business comes in and really makes a difference.
I mean, in these competitions, are you up against other people that do this, what do you call it, the American artisanal blend of cow, sheep, and goat milk?
Oh, sure. There are many different divisions, so it's not like I have the only cheese there. In many cases, for example, when I won Best of Show in Milwaukee, that particular year, I believe that there were about 860 entries. My cheese was judged the best.
Now, that you have to really feel good about that.
Yes, and then in Chicago, when I won Best of Show there, there were 1,368 cheeses, and I had two of the top three.
Wow.
And so these are blind tastings, you know, yet your cheese is picked out randomly and judged by a group of 40, 50 people as being the best. So it's...
Well, you know, we've interviewed a number of winners, like the Vermont Butter and Cheese Company.
Yeah, they're really good.
Oh yeah, they're a great crew.
The guys who were the most splendid, probably,
mm-hmm.
with the exception of yourself, of course, are the Rogue River Creamery guys.
Oh sure,
who knew absolutely nothing about cheese, but mm-hmm. they sort of got to know the guy who owned the place,
who did know about cheese,
and
yeah.
So they kept him on it. But they've learned a tremendous.
Yeah,
and then there's that Mary who does the show.
Mary from Cypress Grove.
Yeah, Mary Keene.
I mean, she just keeps on inventing, and she has such a wonderful sense of humor in all the names that she gives to the cheeses as well.
Oh, yes.
Truffle Tremor is one of her latest.
Now, is there a lingo for describing cheese as a professional cheesemaker or as a cheese aficionado like there is in wine? I mean, it's almost like there's a whole language that wine journalists and wine experts have developed.
Peter, we're working on that. traditionally, when people that graded cheese or gave descriptions of cheese, there was always a lot of negativity. So it was always, things like metallic, weedy, onion, and it was, sour, bitter. Everything was negative. And so I think it's something that cheesemakers, and especially artisan cheesemakers, have really made a difference in the past 5 or 10 years, is that language.
You did use fruity, I heard. Fruit
yes.
tones, fruit notes.
Yes. And so, terms like earthy, fruity, floral, flavors like that, terms like that, where I think cheesemakers are using more of those terms to really give a positive connotation to flavors rather than taking away, because traditionally with the grading systems that we had, the more they could be negative about it, the less they had to pay for the cheese.
Right. Well, let's try a real online real-time experiment. Let's pick one of your cheeses. I don't mind
well,
which.
Could I suggest it?
Yeah, you can if you like.
Because this is the one I seem to be really fascinated by at the moment, which is the Snow White Goat Cheddar.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Now, give us a few distinctive words that say, this goat cheddar is good because.
Well, that one, I think, has a lot of fruitiness. It's very bright. It has some floral flavors to it. There's a lot of complexity, and by complexity, I mean that it has a long finish in your mouth. And right at the end of the finish, you're going to get an earthy flavor because the way the cheese is finished. That one we grow native molds on the surface, and it's it's similar to a traditional farmhouse English cheddar. As far as style,
mm-hmm.
where it has the bandage and has the mold, and it's about a year old. So I think if you said fruity, floral, complex, long finish, earthy, those are all very positive terms that are descriptors of that particular cheese.
And it's got something. It's got another thing that's unique about it, although it's not obvious. There's something about the fact that it's made out of goat's milk rather than cow's milk that makes it more unusual and interesting.
Yes. Yes, and you know, I started making sheep milk. I started making goat milk cheeses about 10, 11 years ago, and I was out at American Cheese Society. It was in Seattle, Washington that year, and it must have been about 96, 97, 98, sometime in there. And I remember it was at a vineyard, and the wines were very, very good. And on the way up the hill to the Festival of Cheeses that was outside, I took a bite of goat cheese. It was the first cheese there. And I put it in my mouth, and it was the most horrible thing that I had ever tasted, and I spit it right out. And I thought to myself then, I really think somebody needs to make wonderful goat milk.
Now, this was not your goat milk cheese. No. This is somebody else's.
It was just one that I picked up. I don't know whose it was, and if I did know, I wouldn't tell
you. Yeah, right. And it's probably not a major producer.
No.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of artisan cheese makers that are still learning how to make cheese. But there are a lot that have really mastered it. And in those days, there really weren't many people making hard cheeses. There were quite a few soft cheeses, but there were not so many hard cheeses.
You mean goats?
Hard goat milk cheeses, yes. And so I made it a passion of mine to make really good ones, and we have been very successful at that.
Now, how do you go about? Now, first of all, let's start with these are not farmstead. These are not your own goats or cows or.
No, we buy our milk from 30 local dairy cow farms, and we have our own trucks, and that goes out and picks up the milk every day. Very fresh, and then we buy our goat milk from a very small group of 8 goat milk farms, and we buy our sheep milk farm, our sheep milk from about 12 sheep milk farms. We're very demanding on quality, and we pay our goat milk farms substantially more money for quality. We insist on picking up the milk with much more frequency than most companies do, and as well as the sheep milk, we only make up fresh sheep milk cheese. We're not buying any frozen milk. And so I guess simply said, it's easy to make good cheese out of really good milk. It is possible to make poor cheese out of really good milk, but it is impossible to make good cheese out of poor milk.
Right.
Right.
How do you structure what you're going to do with the milk? If you're working on something as unique as that?
Well, we work on projections, and what we do is we sit down generally in December, January, after our year has ended, and we decide how much of each of the 80 cheeses we're going to make, and especially with the artisan ones, by what they sold the year before, by how popular they've been. We have 7 of our own retail stores plus an online store, so we have some measure of what's selling in our own retail stores and what that demand will be. And then we go ahead and we set up a schedule for the whole year. And it's actually easier to know how much of the artisan cheeses we're going to make, because generally we make them 1 year and sell them the next, than say a cheese like an 8-year cheddar or a 10-year cheddar, because how much should we put away this year for what we're going to sell?
Right, right. Yeah, so you're sort of playing a little bit of a guessing game. Now you mentioned in passing there that you have a website of which people can buy. So let's just make sure we get that into the program.
Sure. It's carvalleycheese.com. There's 2 R's in the car. It's carvalleycheese.com.
And what about in distribution? Where are you, in Whole Foods or Sonoma, Williams-Sonoma, or places like that?
We have about 80 distributors around the country.
Okay, great.
And so generally Whole Foods anywhere would have some of our cheeses, because we make so many different ones. Different Whole Foods will have different cheeses, but for most Whole Foods, we have about 20 to 25 cheeses on their order board that they can order in from the distributors that service them.
Sure. Is there a store locator that's on the website? Or?
No.
No, okay.
We have, it's just too overwhelming.
Okay.
And You know, for example, we'll have a situation where a distribution company like Atlanta Foods International will be distributing cheese in Southern California. And we'll have where DPI Northwest will be distributing cheeses in Montana. So we don't always know where our cheeses go.
Right.
I have a really funny question that just occurred to me, because we have all this fuss and palaver about importing French cheeses. Do European countries ever import American cheeses? Could we've come so far in the quality of the cheeses we produce.
Well, that's coming. That is coming. There are a few companies that are exporting cheese to Europe, but not very many and not very much, because the Europeans don't realize yet the quality of American cheeses. The ones that have tried them do, but for the most part, Main Street Europe does not.
I guess we need the judgment of Paris, but in cheese.
yeah, sort of. I mean, you know, we do very well when we enter the world contest in Great Britain. We've done very well. We did 2 years ago, and I think we won, you know, like 13 or 14 awards. We do export cheese to Canada, and we do sell some cheese in the Orient.
You do?
Taiwan, Hong Kong, we have a very small distribution out that way.
Well, keep up the great work. I'm sure there must be a generation coming after you that's going to.
I was going to ask that question.
It's going to make sure that the family tradition continues.
Do you have that?
Well, I have two kids, who knows what's going to happen.
What ages are they?
Well, I have a son that is 25, and he has a cheesemaker's license, but isn't really too much interested in it.
Okay.
I have a daughter that is, she's 21, and, you know, they're both yet in school and studying, and so we'll see how that all goes. Well, I think sometimes, you know, it's better just to let them find their own way and see if they have a passion or not, because that's the most important thing.
Yeah, because if they don't, you'll want to find someone who has to keep
that's
on
right.
the tradition.
Well, Sid, it's been so much fun talking to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining the program. It was really fascinating, and I'm just I'm trying to figure out which cheese I'm going to open next.
Yeah, which is your favorite? It's like asking your favorite child. I know.
Well, it's hard to beat an aged cheddar. But I do love the mixed milk cheeses because of their complexity and flavor, and the Snow White is always good. And you
it's
know,
wonderful.
I really like them all.
Well, we do too. So anyhow, thank you again, and I'll keep up the good work, as Peter said.
Well, thank you very much. And if you ever get out to Wisconsin, look us up and come visit the factory.
Absolutely.
Aren't we supposed to go to an apple breeder there too?
It's on a long list of things they're going to do. I'm going to suggest that you go in the middle of February, then you'll be sure to want to go.
Well, sometimes we have a late January thaw. It could be real nice.
Yeah, you have a late January thaw, and the temperature rises above zero Fahrenheit.
Yeah, it's really not that bad.
It's what makes the cows grow. It's what makes the cheese mature. It's just the way it is in Wisconsin.
The way it is.
Sid, once again, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye, Sid.
Bye.
And now it's time to pause once again for the advert.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Moving right along, we are actually going to Utah, which is a most surprising place. The company is called Beehive Cheese, and it's the second company we found that has this incredible terroir in Utah. The other one was Salumeria.
Oh, is that what it
Criminella,
was?
Criminella, yeah.
Okay, I knew we had someone in
terroir
Utah recently, and I got it all messed up.
It replicated the terroir of the Criminelli Salumi in Italia. It's a surprising place. Have I ever been there? Probably not.
I've only been in Utah once, and it was totally fogged in, so I couldn't see anything.
Okay.
And didn't get to the part of the state where, obviously, all this agriculture is going on. But
right.
There is some great agriculture going on, and cheese, of course, is a great product of that. And here's Beehive Cheese talking all about that.
Who knew that there was artisanal cheese in Utah, and who knew that Utah was the beehive state.
Well, I knew it was the beehive state, but our guest knows why.
Yeah, and we're talking to Pat Ford, who's the co-founder of Beehive Cheese, an award-winning cheese company, artisanal cheese company in Utah. So, Pat, tell us, why is Utah called the beehive state?
Utah is the beehive state because way back when the pioneers showed up in Utah and it was a desert, and everybody thought they were nuts, especially the local Indians. But then they started irrigating and doing all sorts of busy stuff. And the word Deseret means honeybee in the Ute Indian language.
Ah.
And so they called them the industrious honeybees or industry, therefore the beehive state.
Well, that's amazing. Now, the first settler, the Mormons were not the first settlers, but they were among the first, Pat?
Yeah, well, the Indians were here, obviously.
Sure, they didn't settle. I guess they were already there.
No, they were just kind of here, and then the trappers. There were a lot of, you know,
yeah,
Jim
right.
Bridger and all those guys, and they told the Mormons they were insane and nuts, and they'd never grow an ear of corn here, and blossomed and gone from there.
It's that Mormons are they're sort of a determined type.
Indeed.
Now, how did you end up in Utah, Pat?
My ancestors were pioneers, so they came across the plains as Mormon pioneers, and they showed up in the valley in 1847 is when they arrived. They were actually with the first company of pioneers, so
wow.
We've been here a long time.
Tell us a little bit more about where you are in the state, Pat.
We are in northern Utah.
Northern, okay.
So Salt Lake's in the north part of the state, but we're about another 40 miles north of Salt Lake. We're in a small town called Uinta, and another Indian word. Just up in the mountains where I tell people I'm 15 minutes from the snow basin, which is the downhill where the Olympics were held. So
uh-huh.
It's kind of distracting on a nice snow day to come and make cheese. But
and you do that? You ski a little bit yourself?
I love to ski.
Yeah, you said you were just popped over to Jackson Hole not too long ago, and I guess
yep.
they ski quite a lot there. Huh?
Yep, they do. We've got some beautiful country.
I was in Jackson Hole once for a conference meeting, a 2-day meeting, but it is a really glorious spot.
It is gorgeous.
The only thing that worries you is when the plane takes off, it seems like it's heading straight into those mountains.
It is.
and you're hoping like hell that the pilot's pulling the lever back so it'll get over them.
Now, Pat, you were not always an artisanal cheesemaker.
I was not.
And your partner, your brother-in-law, also was doing something else. Tell us about that.
Well, Tim is a real foodie. I mean, I love food. He's able to create it like crazy. And he was in the software development business, and I was in the recreational land development business, a family business that we'd done for 33 years. My dad and I were partners, and Tim sold his business back in 2002, and we sold our property in 2004, and Tim called me up one day and said, let's go make cheese, and I laughed. I thought he was kidding.
He actually did it just like that?
Let's go make cheese. Pretty much.
My goodness gracious.
He said, I need money. We'll probably have to work for free, and let's make cheese. And I said, hey, that sounds like a great idea.
Now, what were you doing? You had sold your land. I mean,
I had sold my development, and a friend of ours was in the, of all things, he sold emergency vehicles, like fire engines. And so I was peddling fire engines at the time and just helping him out. And Tim was reading the Cheese Primer by Stephen Jenkins.
And
I mean, an amazing book. And he said, you know what? This artisan cheese thing is happening in the United States, and I don't think it's going away anytime soon.
No, that's amazing. I don't know if you know the West Coast Cheese Humboldt Fogg.
Absolutely.
And we asked the founder of Humboldt Fogg, I can't remember her first name now, We said, well, what, Mary? That's Mary Keene. We said, why did you stop making goat cheese, Mary? And she said, well, I was a single parent with two children. That's how it started.
And
it doesn't seem like the most obvious thing to do if you're a single parent with two children, but
no.
I guess that's what she did, and she's made a wonderful business out of it. Now, do you have a dairy farm as well, or do you buy milk?
I buy milk from one dairy, and they are about 8 miles from me. They're right on the banks of the Great Salt Lake.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it's
good grazing land, even though it's a salty lake, huh?
You know, the lake does make, I mean, it's saline and inhospitable to anything other than brine shrimp, but the shores of the lake are very fertile, and you'd mentioned terroir and whatnot.
Yeah.
Before we started our cheese making here at our creamery that we built, we went up to Utah State, and they helped us develop our recipes, and we actually made cheese in their facility about 6 months before we knew we were going to open down here. And then we make our cheese here, and it tastes completely different than the cheese we made.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing.
I bet it tastes a lot better, too, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the cows, a lot of people ask a lot of questions about the cows and how they're treated and what they eat. And our dairy is just absolutely gorgeous. And that was one of our first big hurdles is you don't just show up to a dairyman and say, I want to buy your milk, because they say, now, who are you, and you're going to show up every day, and you're not going to leave me high and dry, and not to mention
literally
contracts. And
yeah.
So we went to a local cheese company up in Logan, about an hour north of here, and this gal named Dolores has been making Swiss cheese up there for like 60 years, and she was good enough. She handed us a list of 148 dairies that she does business with, and she said, you can have as much or as little as you want, which is a dream come true for us, because if we want to take a week off and not make cheese, then we're not obligated to, you know, take that milk.
Okay, and she had the mechanism already established for doing that, I guess.
Absolutely, and then we just, you know, if we need more or less, we tell her. And we also took our ag inspector with us, and we said, okay, if you were going to eat this cheese, which dairy would you use? And he just smiled, and he took us right to Wade's Dairy.
So he helped you pick, and you just used the one dairy.
One dairy.
Well, that's,
and it's Jersey. Hmm?
Jersey cow.
Right. Well, it's amazing. You think of Jersey cows being small cows, somehow being dwarfed by the size of the state of Utah, and tripping over all the beehives.
There you go.
Now, why cheddar?
Cheddar is, Tim and I started, we had these grandiose visions of a brie hive and make it in the shape of a beehive.
Brie hive, that's very clever. Right?
Much different thing. But then, you know, our goal was to kind of bring back the local creamery that kind of went away back in the 40s. And we did our research, and Utah State, who's an ag school, and they just have done extensive dairy research here in Utah, and they said, you know what, we have these recipes that we've been working on for like 80 years.
Oh, wow.
And do you want them? And, of course, we said yes. And, in fact, Don McMahon, who's the dean of the department up there, is coming down today, and we're going to meet again on a new cheese that we're developing. But it's just an amazing thing, and cheddar just kind of happened. And
well, tell us about the different kinds of cheese you produce. I mean, even though they're mainly cheddar-related, you do different things to them, right?
We do. And that's been kind of our claim to fame. We have kind of a tagline from Shakespeare where it says, therein lies the rub. And we rub things on the cheese, and our base cheese, we call it a cheddar-type cheese. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the cheese-making process, but cheddaring is actually a process in making cheese. Are you familiar with that?
I think I probably was, but it was really the method of cheese-making that was developed in the place where cheddar is made in England, in Somerset.
Yep.
So the cheddaring process takes its name from the Cheddar Gorge, which I guess is the heart of the cheese-making tradition, and the cheese called cheddar. So they're all related to each other, and it's a piece of geography rather than describing a manufacturing process.
Exactly. When you make cheese, I'll just kind of, do you want me to give you like a...
Sure, why not?
Tutorial? So when you make cheese, you warm up your milk, and then you add your cultures, and the cultures eat the sugars or the lactose in milk. And when they eat the sugars, they convert them to lactic acid. And it's the acid that makes the curd and whey want to separate.
Oh, yeah.
And so we'll get the acid acidification started, and then you add rennet. And rennet is the coagulant which sets the cheese and basically turns it from milk to yogurt.
Right, so you're taking the curd part of the milk.
Yep.
And then setting it with rennet.
Yep.
Okay.
And then once it's set, and that's just in a magical process, in about 30 minutes it turns from fluid milk to a real stiff yogurt.
Amazing.
And then you take a harp that's strung by a quarter inch apart, and you drag that through the curd, and you cut the curd, and as soon as you do that, the curd and whey start to separate. It's just amazing. And then you'll stir it around with basically a rake and separate the curd and whey, and then you cook the curd and whey, and, you know, cook's somewhat of a misnomer because you only go up to 102 degrees, which is about the temperature of a hot tub. But you cook it, and then you drain your whey off, and if you're doing a cheddaring process, you allow the curd to go into a big slab in the bottom of the vat, and you'll take a knife and cut it into manageable strips, and then you turn those strips over, and that's called cheddaring the cheese.
Okay. All right. Now, cheddar cheeses, though, in at least in England, have a round shape.
Yep.
I mean, how do they get to be round?
And then what happens is, after the... While it's cheddaring, the bacteria are creating the acid, and you want the acid production to be just right. You can't have too much acid or it'll ruin the cheese. So in order to slow down the acid, basically you run the slabs of cheese through a mill called a curd mill, and it cuts it into chunks or curds about the size of your thumb. And then in order to slow down the bacteria or the cultures, you add salt, and salt stops them in their tracks. They don't make any more acid.
Okay.
And then I take those curds and I put them in a cheesecloth lined hoop or a round wheel.
Okay, so this is where the wheel part comes in.
Yep.
And it's why cheese thus called cheesecloth.
Exactly.
Oh, that's interesting. I never even thought about that.
Although we use it for a variety of different uses, it was designed to have just the right structure to hold the form but at the same time let some air in. Is that the deal?
Uh-huh.
You know, why did I never question that? I mean, that's funny. It never even occurred to me to ask why it's called cheesecloth.
You just write it on the board, and I go to the store and buy it. you don't need to know why it's called that. Why would it be as simple as it being called toilet paper? I mean, you never asked the question about toilet paper, so you know about cheesecloth. Now, what happens then? The cheese still continues to develop. And the longer it's aged, in general, it's considered to be better? Is that the deal?
Well, better depending on the palate.
Okay.
I mean, some people may like a real nice mild cheese, and some people may like a real strong, sharp cheddar. A curd, we sell a lot of curds, and people love them just as a snack food. And those are you'll take the cheese that you've run through the cheese mill after you've salted them, and you'll bag them and sell them. And they squeak on your teeth. They call them squeaky curds.
Now they're big in Wisconsin, aren't they?
They are huge.
Cheese curds are really huge in Wisconsin.
Yep, and you can tell how fresh the curd is by how much it squeaks.
Oh my!
It squeaks on your teeth, and then what's happening is, as time goes on, the proteins in the milk are broken down by the cultures, and they continue. They go from a squeaky, chewy, kind of rubbery consistency to a nice, smooth, creamy cheddar, but that's what Mother Nature does over time.
Now, when do you start flavoring them up with your rubs?
That's where I get, like the day after I press my cheese, I'll take them out of the hoops, and they're just real soft and real susceptible to the flavorings that we'll add. And Barely Buzzed is the name of our coffee and lavender rub that we came up with, and we'll grind the coffee beans and grind the lavender buds and rub it on the cheese, and then
I like that a lot. That
we'll
cheese.
Age it for about 5 months to a year, just depending on the batch.
Okay, well, this is really absolutely amazing. Now, listeners, I'm going to ask a question, but I have a feeling I know the answer already. So you may have to take our word for it that this is really lovely cheese. So we say it, Peter and Ann say it, and Pat says it's good too. But have you been entering any competition? There are lots of competitions in the cheese business. So have you been doing any of that?
We have, and the Barely Buzzed, I'll kind of back up a little bit. My partner Tim's brother is a coffee roaster in Colorado.
Oh, okay, so that's got something
coffee,
to do with it, too.
We had some coffee basically laying around that we hadn't sold, and we thought, what are we going to do with that coffee? And we ground it up and put it on the wheel. Originally, we did two little three-pound wheels, and we aged it. And just before the American Cheese Society competition in Portland back in 2005, we broke out one of those wheels and tasted it and said, this is really good.
It is good.
we really got onto something here.
I mean, it's so bizarre. People think, you did what? But then we took it, the other one, we cut it up in little chunks and thought we'd get some experts' opinions while we were up there. And a gal named Maureen, she used to be the buyer for Wild Oats. She's now, have you heard of Haystack?
I haven't, no.
They're a small goat creamery out of Colorado.
Okay.
And they make marvelous, beautiful
cheese. What's it called?
Haystack.
It's called Haystack.
Okay.
But she tasted it and started making a big fuss over it. And a friend of hers came by who was the buyer for Central Market in Texas that has some beautiful markets. And he bought 70 wheels on the spot.
My God, that was a good day, huh?
That was a huge day for us.
you hadn't even made them yet, right?
We had never. We said, we don't know if we can do it again. And he said, well, can you or can't you? And I said, well, sure we can.
give us an order for 70 wheels and come back in six
exactly.
months.
Exactly. But then we entered that cheese the following year in Burlington, Vermont. And then in Chicago, and then in Austin at the ACS the last 3 years, and we took first place all 3 years.
Well done, well done. I think I sort of knew the answer there, but it was nice to drag it out of you. Now,
well, thank you.
Now, there's one last thing before we let you go. We have to find out for listeners where they're going to be able to get Beehive Cheese. So, do you have a store locator or anything like that on your website?
We do. On our website, you can go to Find Our Cheese. And our website is beehivecheese.com, and it'll tell you where we are located in your local area. And if you can't get it in your local area, we ship all over the country.
Oh, great.
And we just do really fun holiday gifts, and all year round, we ship beautiful cheese around.
I mean, they're really unusual, listeners, the cheeses. I mean, you have one that's apple walnut smoked, you have Cajun rubbed. You have rosemary, habanero. I mean, really interesting flavors.
They're fun. That apple walnut smoke just took third in the world at the World Cheese Competition.
Oh, the one in England?
Yep. It was actually in the last 27 years, it's only been outside of England two times, and it was in the Canary Islands.
That's right. It was, yes.
Yep.
Oh, no, that's a big, big prize.
That's kind of the World Cup of Cheese.
Oh, boy.
That's the big one.
Well, congratulations to you, and I can say you certainly deserve it. I mean, we just enjoyed it enormously.
Yeah, when you invent some more flavors, don't forget we'll be happy to be part of the testing team.
We will do that.
Pat, thank you so much.
What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, Pat. It's great to finally talk to you.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's a wrap for another week. Before we go, we should wish you all the very best. As the new year rolls around, and it's hard to believe we're in 2010 already, or we will be by the time next week's program, but we'll be here, same time, same place. We hope you will be too. So between now and then,
bye-bye.